leader.
Okay.
And his staff job was preparing the menus, and which was a, and he had a head of staff of people that helped him with that. And then we had a lady who was in charge of training, and her area management, her direct management responsibility, her line manager responsibility was West Circle. But then she had the training aspect for the whole housing group. And then we had, at that time, a whole series of snack shop operations. Each big residence hall had a cash operation snack shop in it. And that was another person's responsibility to be the resource person for the operation of these businesses. So I did that until 1967. And in 1967, we had things like the Equal Employment Opportunity Act. And then we had our first major union contract began to be signed then. Supervision was kind of moving towards organizing itself at that time. And Emory Foster, who I've mentioned before, decided that he needed a staff person to be responsible for personnel and labor relations. There was a lot of work going into grievance hearings and all of that kind of stuff, and our managers really didn't know how to deal with unions and union stewards and union the union management and interpretations of the contract, which is a nice thick little book. And unless you negotiated the thing, as I had been doing, you really didn't understand what was in it. It was hard to understand what was in it, so people needed interpretation. So they created this job as personnel administrator. And I was the first guy, first person in that job. And I did that for a couple of years, and then some promotions happened, and Emory moved up, and Lyle Thorburn moved up, and I became manager of residence halls. And
Was President Hanna still? Or was
Hanna was
Hanna
here
until
67.
Okay.
He was here until 67.
Did so you're the president you had dealing with, and this was this Wharton, or?
Well, let's see.
You dealt with the interim presidents like Adams or?
Oh yeah, I dealt with Adams because I was one of the university negotiators in the basement of Wilson Hall when the black students took over Wilson Hall cafeteria in 1967. Mm-hmm. And
would you talk a little bit about that?
Well, that was a pretty scary experience for us. We didn't really know what was going on. I was sitting in Mr. Foster's office with Mr. Thorburn at the time, and we got a call saying that there were like 900, however many, 100 students that kind of came in to take over Wilson Hall cafeteria. So I immediately was dispatched to go over there, and I went over there, and the students were kind of running around all over the place, and our staff didn't know what to do, and I didn't know what to do. Things finally settled down a little bit, and the whole issue got started because one of our cooks thought that she was being discriminated against. Not many people know. I've never read it in the history of Adam's book or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But what really happened in that case was one of our supervisors was accused of harassing a cook, and there was an uncertainty and unrest in the black student community at that time, and somehow this got communicated. And so the students decided that they would defend her. And the person who was supposed to have done the harassing was referred to as the blonde supervisor. Well, there was a food supervisor in that unit who was blonde, but it also happened that the manager of the unit was also a blonde. And so the manager of the unit ended up being the blonde supervisor, and that she and then that food super, the food manager of that unit, the next day were hauled in front of sort of a kangaroo court in the middle of the Wilson cafeteria with all of these accusations being thrown at them. Mm-hmm. And they had that point in time, it's kind of hazy at this point. Mm-hmm. But then there were the management people on one side and the employee and the students on the other side, and a lot of shouting and yelling going on. And finally it was decided that a group of student representatives along with a group of university representatives would meet down in the basement of Wilson Hall Center Section and work out the details. And the demands were that the employees be fired. And that was basically what the demands were. And so I was with a group of, it included Emory Foster and our vice president for student affairs at the time. And two black professors. One was Professor Hamilton, who was since...
James Hamilton?
Jim Hamilton. Mm-hmm. And the other one was a professor named Vance, who was a math professor, and the student representatives. And we kind of came to an impasse because we were not really willing to fire these employees because they were really not the ones that were responsible. They were taking the heat for this, but they really weren't the ones responsible for it. But as the managers of the area, they had their responsibility. I'm not trying to shirk that. I mean, mm-hmm. If you're the manager, you end up being responsible for it. Mm-hmm. And anyway, we finally ended up going to Walter Adams and saying, we can't agree. They really want to fire these people, and we can't agree to that. And he essentially said, you go back downstairs and settle the matter. And so we went back downstairs and we agreed that the food service manager would have to leave. To me, it was a low point in my career. Hmm. And we reassigned the manager to other duties. And then we had to take on as a supervisor as a full-time employee in a supervisory position one of the black student group leaders' spouses. And okay. So she sort of became the on-site observer. This person wasn't particularly skilled in the food service area. I don't remember any other concession that we made on the thing, but anyway, it got settled. Mm-hmm. But a lot was scary. I mean, there was a question of whether the National Guard was going to be brought in to empty out this, you know, mm-hmm. building. That was a decision that, you know, the trustees and Walter Adams and the vice presidents of the university at that time had to make. It wasn't made, but that was a consideration. For those of us who were doing the negotiations, those went on 24 hours. We were let to go home to sleep for 8 hours and then come back and do it again. I mean, in 67, we were fresh in the middle of the student revolution mm-hmm. at that point in time. It was an interesting time to be on campus, I gotta tell you.
Was there any destruction of the building at the time, or nothing
really,
to speak
not
of?
Not really, mm-hmm. no. We mm-hmm. opened up the food service and started feeding the students that were in the boycott or in the takeover. We started feeding them the next day. I mean, we locked up the food that night, but mm-hmm. we opened up for breakfast the next morning and started feeding them again. Somebody, you know, you had to take care of this. Mm-hmm. And no, I don't think there was a lot of tension. It kind of really was. I don't remember any damage that really happened. Mm-hmm. We didn't get a tremendous amount of damage during the student unrest of the 60s in the housing system. Mm-hmm. They damaged a demonstration hall, knocked out windows over there because the ROTC was over there, and a lot of the demonstrations took place in the marching field there in front of Dem Hall, but gotta tell you, the scariest thing, one of the scariest things that happened to me one time was they had a big demonstration on campus, and the SDS were here, and they rallied the students to something, and they were doing it over, I think, at Dem Hall, but they sent the crowd out to gather up more students. And they sent them from some central location on campus to South Campus. And my office at that time was in Holmes Hall. And I walked out into the middle of Shaw Lane and looked down towards the west. And here was this mass of humanity coming at me. I mean, there were thousands of students coming down that road. And they were peeling off and going into the residence halls. And I didn't know whether it was to destroy them or what. But really what they were trying to do was just not, they went in and knocked on doors to try to get students to go and join them.
Yeah, increase the size of the crowd.
Yeah, but when you don't know what's going on and you see that coming at you, it's another one of those real sinking feelings that you get in your tummy. So, that was the time, you know, that was when the students, we had men living on one side of Snyder Phillips and women on the other. We still had single-sex residence halls at the time. And then during the 60s, that's when the students tore off the doors that separated the two buildings in the basement and decided they were going to integrate and all of that kind of stuff. And, and my boss, Lyle Thorburn, was, well, he wasn't my boss at the time. Emory Foster was my boss, but he was the guy that had to negotiate all of that stuff. And that was another scary time. But, you know, you go from West Campus, West Circle was all women. Mason Abbott might have been all women at that time. Snyder Phillips was half men, half women. Shaw was all men. The big halls were co-ed halls, but there were co-ed halls by North Case was women and the South Case was men, that kind of stuff. And that's gone. Well, what do you got now? You got men and women living on the same side of the building. They may have men and women living in the same floors now. I don't know. Quite a change. It was quite a change.
Mm-hmm. And you were there for a lot of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We were there in the middle of all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. What in after you were director of personnel?
Yeah.
And then what happened in your career?
Then I became manager of residence halls.
Okay, manager of residence
halls. Yeah. Okay. I think I became manager of residence halls in 1968.
Okay.
And I did that until 12 years.
Okay.
And then around the 80s, I became Assistant Vice President for Housing and Food Service. And I did that till I retired. I don't know exactly whether those dates are right on the money, but they're close enough.
In the 70s and 80s, how did your job change?
Well, it was funny. I try to look at it from the standpoint that in the... Up until the time I retired, there had been three people who had the job of Assistant Vice President for Housing and Food Service. Emory Foster was the first one. Lyle Thorburn was the second one. And I was the third one. And if you had to divide up sort of the decades, you'd have to say that the builder of the system was Emory Foster. He was in charge when the place was exploding. Dr. Hanna used to have this big map of the campus in his office, and on it were little models of the buildings that existed. And then it was in kind of like in blue and green or something, or green and yellow or something like that. And buildings that were built with general fund money were one color, and buildings that were built with borrowed money, which was all housing and food service, were another color. Buildings that were planned but not, you know, in the process of being built were in a different color. And then there were outlines of buildings. And those buildings went all the way from the railroad tracks to Mount Hope, and all the way down Mount Hope, and all the way back down Farm Lane. And that's when everybody thought this place was going to be 60 or 70,000 students. And so they started on that building program. And Emory's job was taken up, a lot of that job was taken up on meetings with architects and contractors, and everything was tied around expansion. So he was the builder. And then Lyle got into the job when we had these huge numbers of people to take care of, you know, in the 67 and 68, 69, and in those periods of time when we had the 19,000 students in the housing system. His was a kind of a maintenance job. The units were new enough at that point in time where they didn't require a lot of repair. And so his job was concentrated and focused on feeding those students and housing those students and where are we going to put those students. And then also dealing with some of these changes that were going on, these social changes that were going on. And when I got to the job, I had to rebuild them. That was sort of my job, was to redo them.
Somewhere 30 years, 20 years.
Yeah, they were getting to be 20 years old. Mm-hmm. And the vice president of business at the time, Hannah, was in charge. And Dr. Hannah, when they figured out how to finance these things, the notion was, we're not going to build reserves for major maintenance. What we're going to do is pay them off in 20 years. And when we pay them off, then that dollars, those dollars that were going into the payment of the bonds would be used to rehabilitate the buildings. And by golly, that's what happened. Mm-hmm. Unlike a lot of campuses where other campuses did two things. They borrowed the money and built the buildings, and then it built into their room and board, they set aside huge amounts of reserves to take care of building maintenance, which was a smart thing to do at the time. However, funding and the cost of running colleges and universities grew faster than anybody thought, and the funding shrank. And so those schools that had these huge housing reserves out there, those reserves got taken away and used for academic purposes, construction, and other expenses. So when it came time to rebuild, there wasn't any rebuilding funds for those, and so they were starting to really hurt. Some of those buildings were really getting beat up, and a lot of campuses suffered from that. When the other thing happened was, is if they did it the way Michigan State did it, and that was pay off the bonds as fast as you can, and then when you're done paying on the bonds, then use the money to rebuild. When that money became available, it just got siphoned off into the rest of the university general fund. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so that group of people, those schools that did that, were stuck mm-hmm. with deteriorating housing facilities, not able to bring them up to date, not able to paint them, you know, not able to change out the food services to meet the needs of the new student that's coming in. Because you got to remember, these kids that are starting to come to you now in the 70s and in the 80s and in the 90s heard about Burger King when they were still in their mom's womb. I mean, that was fast food, was that. Things were changing, you know.
That wasn't just a straight line down the cafeteria.
No, none of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And the old cafeterias were dull, and they were stainless steel, and they were uninviting, and the floors weren't carpeted, and the furniture was metal, and it was just, you know, it was like prison service almost. Prison service is like that now. And while we couldn't stay like that, we had to change these things. You see Shaw Hall over here right now is closed, 2 years, gutted, having to be redone. Well, Shaw Hall was built in the 50s, you know, so that's a 50-year-old building.
Yep.
There was one other thing that Michigan State did right, and that is when they built the buildings, they built high-quality buildings. These buildings lasted a long, long time because of the standards that were used to construct them. All right. Anyway, get back to what Michigan State did right, and that was, the plan was pay off the buildings and then put the money back in, and that's what the housing system has been able to do. through the efforts of Roger Wilkinson, who was the vice president for business here for a long time, the funds that we generated for, that we had once generated for paying bonds, was now being able to be funneled back in to begin the business of maintenance on these buildings. Building window systems had to be changed. Heating systems had to be changed. Furniture was worn out. Furniture had to be changed. There were new OSHA regulations and safety regulations that had to be met. And because of the long-term, far-reaching point of view of Hannah and his staff, and the support from Roger Wilkinson that we received all during this period of time, we were able to make those plans happen. We were able to make that vision that they had work. Mm-hmm. So my job was to kind of rebuild, start the rebuilding. We rebuilt Kellogg Center. Kellogg Center was built with money from the Kellogg Foundation, but they never pay for maintenance. The foundation will give you the money to build a place, and it's your baby after that. Yeah. And so the only thing that they did help us with in the remodeling of Kellogg Center was where we added new facilities. We added quite a bit of new teaching facilities for the School of Hospitality Business. Mm-hmm. We added double the size of the Big Ten room. And they helped they helped a lot in that. They were very helpful in that.
What was your, did you have any ongoing relationship with the School of Hotel Restaurant?
Well, we tried. Institution Management? We tried over the years, and we tried to work with them as closely as possible. Being a graduate, Emory Foster was a graduate of that school also. Lyle Thorburn was a graduate of the Ag School, and I was a graduate of it. So we tried, and it was funny, over the years, Emory would try and offer to help as much as he could, but it basically got turned away. Mm-hmm. I had a good working relationship with most of the directors that they brought in, and I think the relationship still exists strongly. They had it not been for Housing and Food Services willing to invest a couple of million dollars in new classrooms and laboratory facilities in Kellogg Center, you wouldn't see what's in Kellogg Center right now. Mm-hmm. We did that without, nobody asked for that. They needed new space. We wanted to reconfigure the building. We found out what it was that they wanted, and we built it for them.
Mm-hmm. What were the biggest changes in that renovation?
Oh, and for HRI?
Mm-hmm. Or for even for the Kellogg Center?
Well, that thing started out as the guts of the building were basically worn out. The air conditioning, there were 13 different air conditioning systems in the building. The wiring was inadequate for the kind of work that we wanted to do. The kitchen was worn out. So we started out with a rewiring project for $750,000, which grew to a air conditioning project, which grew to a Kellogg Center's rooms are out of date and too small. They were very small rooms, and they all had twin beds in them, and it referred back to an era when you brought people in and you put two in a room, two strangers in a room together, and they accepted all of that. The hotel business and the conference business has changed. Holiday Inn has big rooms and twin beds, and not twin beds, but queen king-size beds, and the industry changed, but Kellogg did not. So we felt we had to, in order to make it pay, and it was losing a lot of money. Kellogg had been a drain on the finances of Housing and Food Service for a long time. So even if we made it break even, you know, we would save $500,000 a year. We were losing a lot of money in that place. Mm-hmm. And so our job was, let's just get it to break even. Well, you can't get it to break even if you got a crappy facility. Mm-hmm. The wood paneling that was in the hallway was built in early 1950s, so it was 40 years old. Everything was old. So then we decided that we need to take, instead of 195 rooms, we reduced this number of rooms in the hotel to 165. And we did a lot of one for two conversions. And we took two rooms and made one room out of it. Or we took three rooms and made two rooms out of them. Redid all of the bathrooms in there because they were terrible. Redid the plumbing. and we decided that it needed a parking ramp. It had a 350 car parking lot beside it that when it snowed became like a 200 car lot. And then people had to walk from the corner across from Breslin in a big parking lot there down. And so people that I worked for agreed that a parking deck was appropriate for that. So we built a 1,000 car parking ramp on it. And then the Big Ten room was too small. And at that time, Big Ten room and the Centennial room was one room. And you ran a divider down the middle of it, and you could make the Centennial room a separate room and the Big Ten room a separate room. So we doubled the size of that. And then underneath it, we were able to put an expansion of a public cafeteria and more conference rooms, a very nice executive training room downstairs, expanded the HRI facilities down there, gave them a nice dining room, a wonderful kitchen to work in. Actually gave them two kitchens. We gave them a teaching kitchen, and we gave them a regular kitchen. Then we gave them a 95-seat amphitheater with cooking facilities and the mirrors and all of that kind of stuff. It was pretty nice.
Now, so you like started out as a wiring project.
$34 million later, we have what we have now, mm-hmm. and we've got Kellogg Center moved from a money loser to one that was able to make its own way and have enough money to take care of its own maintenance. And I think they're still doing it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What were some of the other presidents that you worked with?
Oh, golly, we had...
that meant to be a quiz. You were Dr. Wharton?
Yeah, Dr. Mm-hmm. Wharton came in, and they were wonderful people. They my staff would say, at that time, when the Hannas lived there and Adams used the house, I don't think Adams lived there. I think he just used the house to entertain with. Mm-hmm. The food service in the house was taken care of by the Union Building. After the Hortons arrived, we tried a couple of different ways of doing that, and finally Kellogg Center took over the catering for that facility. And I think that Mrs. Wharton really taught the staff a lot about how to manage and operate that kind of a facility. It was almost an embassy kind of.
Sure.
They had a lot of experience with that, mm-hmm. Kind of living anyway, but it just brought a new level of service to Cole's house. And I think some remodeling, you'd have to talk with the physical mm-hmm. plant people, but because I don't remember when all the remodeling began to take mm-hmm. place. At that time, there's a young man named Jack Burns was the manager of Kellogg Center, and he got along quite well with Mrs. Wharton. Mm-hmm. And so it started Cole's house towards the kind of food service and housing service that they have over there right now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all the rest of the people, the interims, that we had, and when other presidents would come along, and their lifestyle would be different. Each president and spouse lifestyle was different, mm-hmm. and they approached their use of Cole's house differently, and so we would adjust to that as time went by. Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Wharton has indicated that. One of the things that she did right after her husband arrived, she started going out, staying in the dorm.
Oh, yeah. And yeah, she did that.
Were you involved in that?
Yeah, I remember that.
I mean, no, I can imagine getting a phone call saying, yeah. Mrs. Wharton's going out to Holden Hall.
Yeah,
something.
I did that, too.
You did?
Yeah, okay. I did the same thing. I would go out, and she would go out, and we'd had these grad advisor apartments. I don't think Mrs. Wharton lived with the students, but she mm-hmm. might have. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. But we had these grad assistant apartments in the buildings, and we would go in, and I would go in and stay in those. Mm-hmm. You know, and the kids would. I would only go if they invited me.
Okay.
I made it known to the students that I'd go out and I'll tell you, when you start to doing that, you realize what goes on and how active a residence hall is at 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning. I mean, that's when everybody's there. I mean, the rest of the time it's pretty calm because no one is around.
Yeah.
You know, they're off to class, they're playing intramural sports, they're eating, they're working, they're doing whatever they do.
Yeah.
They're not in their rooms.
Everybody's back at
it. Boy, at 2 o'clock in the morning, especially after the bars close, because a lot of them build the bars rather, you know, legal or not, place gets pretty active 2-3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, she did that. That was fun when she was able to do that. I think the students really appreciated that too. What did she say about?
Well, no, she said she enjoyed it, and I'm just wondering if you had any other special
about her initial immersion onto into campus.
She said students were surprised, and that pleasantly surprised that the president's wife would be willing to spend the night in the dorm, and that sort of thing.
Well, she's a very gracious lady. I mean,
sure,
she's a terrific lady.
Yeah. But I was wondering, because I wondered if that caused any special problems for you as director of residence halls.
We just did what we normally would do, you know, and our attitude was we were doing the best job that we could for the students. And so there wasn't any way to go in and puff up something, you know. Mrs. Wharton was going to see the housing system for what it was, and she did that. And I don't remember that there were lots of changes as a result of for visiting these places. Most of the time when faculty and staff would come in and do these visits, they would come away amazed. Some of our greatest